Hey, this is Jay Young with King Operating. Have you ever considered paying less money in taxes? Would you like to do what the wealthy do and invest in oil and gas? Go on our website, kingoperating.com, and get my book about our model, ADD, Acquire, Develop, and Divest, or call our number 214-420-3000 to talk to somebody today about investing in oil and gas and saving money on your taxes.
The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
Hey, everybody. This is Jay Young, your host of The Jay Young Show, and I've got a great guest for you today. We're talking some before the camera came on, and just some really good stories about Bill. And his name is Bill Exeter. Got in the financial industry in the 1980. Then he started with this thing called a 1031 in 1986. We're going to talk about Bill Exeter today. Welcome, Bill, to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here, and thanks for having us.
Absolutely. As I look forward to our conversations, I know that a lot of things that you talked about is, you know, your life and what's going on. So we want to kind of go through some of this, maybe some of the challenges you've had during the way, because not everybody's saw a 1031 the same or whatever, but kind of give us an idea of where you grew up, your schooling, and just kind of something about yourself.
I grew up in Los Angeles, which was great back then. Today, I try to avoid it at all costs.
I bet.
The traffic up there, you know, the shortcuts used to work. They don't work anymore, and so it's just traffic. But anyways, grew up in L.A. and went to school all the way through college up in Los Angeles. Focus was mostly on accounting, finance, and tax. Worked for a bank in Glendale at the time, and the chairman decided to get into the 1031 exchange business. And the outside counsel said, don't have your escrow subsidiary run it. We think that's an issue. So he threw it at me, and I had no clue what a 1031 exchange was. So you don't really go to college thinking, I'm going to be a 1031 exchange guy. And all of a sudden, there we are. So my background's all kind of accounting, finance, and tax. And it was kind of a natural fit there. So I did a kind of a right turn with my career, left the banking world, and has been in the 1031 exchange and trust services business ever since.
Well, so when somebody runs up to you at a Starbucks and says, hey, what do you do for a living? You go, I'm in the 1031 business. I mean, you wouldn't say, I know you're too humble to say, I'm Bill Exeter. I'm the Mr. 1031 of Southern California. You just say, I'm in the 1031 business. How do you define a 1031?
Well, usually when I bring it up at the coffee shop or the elevator spiel, their eyes just glaze over. So that's always the first hurdle. But it's really it's a tax-deferred strategy where you can sell rental, investment, or business-use property and defer the taxes. So it's all about deferring taxes, keeping your money in your pocket, and which really allows you to reinvest in bigger properties, larger properties, more doors, more cash flow, and increasing your net worth. So that's probably the quick spiel, and that's about when their eyes glaze over.
So if I own a building, and I've owned a building for – let's say 5 years, 10 years, and I buy it for $2 million, I sell it for $3 million, I've got $1 million profit. So what do I do with my money? Do I take it out and put it in my pocket and then do a 1031, or do I have to give it to you first?
Yeah, so it depends on what you want to do. Some people are going to sell cash out and pay the tax. There's other strategies they might use, but in most cases, if they want to stay in real estate, they're going to sell that $3 million asset. We're going to become involved prior to closing, and we actually have the purchase and sale agreement assigned to us. So we step into their shoes literally as the seller. And when the sale closes, those proceeds are wired to us, and that begins the 1031 exchange process. And then they have to go and buy one or more properties as replacement properties. And the total value has to be equal or greater than that $3 million value. So the government's really saying you've got this $3 million asset, and as long as you remain fully invested, we're going to let you defer the tax.
Okay, so in what is the tax? In California, is there a difference in tax in California compared to Texas, and how much money I pay in taxes?
Yeah, at the federal level, you're going to have your capital gain tax, which would likely be 20%, which is the top rate. You're going to have depreciation recapture taxes if you've depreciated any of the property with improvements on it. It's probably going to trigger some kind of Medicare surcharge, which is that 3.8%. People probably know it as the Obamacare tax. Then you've got state taxes potentially. So in Texas, you wouldn't have state taxes. California, our state taxes can be as high as 13.3%. Most people are probably in the 10, 11, 12% area, but if you sell real estate and you got $1 million gain, you're right at that 13.3%. That's ridiculous.
Wow. So is that like 40% or 50%?
So yeah, when you add it all together, it's in California at least, you're probably about 35%. There's a lot of other variables that can affect that calculation, but right around 35% would be a good estimate.
Oh, wow. Wow. So that means that me taking my $1 million and put it in my bank account and paying taxes, I'd pay $350,000.
You would, yep. At least, because then you're going to have probably depreciation recapture. So the $1 million would be your capital gain. That would be taxed, and then you're going to have your depreciation recapture. So it would likely be more than
$350,000. Wow. Golly. So I could either, let's just say $400,000 just for grins and talk about numbers. So instead of me paying $400,000, I'd give you the $1 million 1031 or the $1 million distribution. And then your license and all we talked about on the webinar we had, you know, but so then what you do is I look for another piece of property. So I've got, is it 45 days from the time that I exit and I give you the $1 million, and then I have 45 days to go find another piece of property to invest
in. Exactly. It all starts with the closing of the sale. So if the closing occurred today, tomorrow would be day number one. And you have 45 calendar days to actually identify what you're going to acquire. An additional 135 days after that to complete the 1031 exchange for a total of 180 days.
Okay.
So
180
is not so bad. It's that 45 days, it can be pretty stressful.
Yeah. And I mean, this show is sponsored by King Operating Corporation. So let's just kind of, if you're not looking for commercial real estate or real estate and you want to do an energy program, our program is designed around a 1031. And it is, if you will, just like one of your real estate programs, our DST is designed for people that want to diversify out of real estate into energy. And so you can do a 1031 into energy with our program.
Absolutely. Yep. And a lot of people, it just amazes me. There's still curriculum out there that says if you sell a condo, you have to buy a condo. If you sell apartments, you have to buy apartments. And a lot of people don't realize that's completely wrong. Anything that's considered real estate would qualify, including certain types of oil and gas interests, water rights, air rights, mineral rights, et cetera. So there's a lot of, you know, the definition of a like kind is very broad. There's a lot of opportunities to diversify the investor's portfolio.
Right, right. I know that there was a lot of people putting oil and gas royalty programs together because of that like-kind exchange. And I didn't like it. I mean, it's just the returns weren't good for the investor. So it wasn't, this will be the best return, in my opinion. This will be the best return for somebody in oil and gas instead of royalty where you get income, but it's be hard to get your money back over 10 years, 20 years. Our program is designed differently. So that's a little sidestep in there. Just, I mean, really to throw it in, but man, it just seemed like I needed to there. I don't want people to think that you can only go into real estate. There is air rights, there's water rights, there's all these different ways that you can design a 1031 exchange. So, you know, that's right. I mean, 40%. Boy, that's a big number. Man, that is a big number. And some people just say that they don't want to go back into real estate because they have to manage the property. And so they just pay the taxes and just, you know, go on to the next chapter of their life. But, you know, we manage oil and gas properties all over. And so we know how to do that as, you know, other real estate programs can. So, well, so you've been doing 1031s. Has it changed any in the past? What is it? 26 years?
Yeah, this is actually my 36th year doing exchange, going to my 36 years. And, you know, so 1031s have been around since 1921. So there's been a lot of iterations over the years. When I got into it, the IRS hadn't issued their regulations yet. So it was kind of the wild, wild west. And we had a group that ultimately became the industry trade group that I was part of. And so I was one of a handful of founders of the trade group. And we'd sit down and it basically became, I don't know, this is how I would do it. How would you do it? I don't know. This is how I would do it. How would you do it? And that's really kind of what it was, because nobody really knew what the IRS's position would be. And we had some case law and things like that. But until they issued the actual final regulations in 1991, it was kind of uncharted territory. Wow. And then over time, so, you know, the 86 Tax Act had a major impact on our world because it took away a lot of the benefits of owning real estate. So the 1031 exchange was one of the last surviving tax strategies for real property. So it exploded. December 31st, 1986 was a long night.
Wow.
But that's when everybody started doing exchanges. It really took off after that. And then we've had changes as we go throughout. But the basics have always been kind of the same. Once they came out with the regulations, you haven't seen a lot of changes in the actual basic, the 45 days, the 180 days, and reinvestment requirements and things like that.
How big is that business? How many, is there just a few 1031s that happen every day, or is there, how big is the 1031 business?
It's hard to track it. That, you know, they come out with numbers every now and then, but it's always about 4 to 5 years late by the time they come out with them. So it's hard to say where they're at. Of course, this year is going to be different with the COVID-19 virus. And, you know, nothing really tracks whether it's a 1031 exchange at the county recorder's office. There's nothing on the deeds that say this is a 1031 exchange. So they really have to wait till the Treasury accumulates all the data off of the 8824s that are filed with the tax returns and they come back. And by the time that's issued, it's kind of outdated.
Hmm. Okay. So, but you're saying it's a pretty good sized business. So
pretty good sized business. I mean, there's before the 2008 recession, there was about 450, 475 members in the industry trade group. And after the recession, it had dropped way below 100 members. And so I'm not sure where it's at today. I haven't seen the numbers today, but it just shows you it's a, you know, with maybe say 500 qualified intermediaries throughout the country, it's a smaller industry per se, but there's enough activity to keep 500 companies going.
So there's 500 companies or 500 QIs?
Probably 500 qualified intermediaries, okay, or QIs, if you will. But that's really the way I'm using it is that would be the company. Okay. You know, a lot of the qualified intermediaries are kind of smaller mom and pop shop, you know, 1, 2, 3 employee shops. They probably do 10, 20 deals a month per se. Then you get all the way up into the big four that do obviously quite a bit more than that. So the total numbers are a little misleading at this point.
Yeah. So even a small, and you're calling out of the 500, a small office does 10 to 20 a month?
That's yeah, 10 to 20 a month. That's a lot. And, you know, a couple of the ones we know well here in our backyard, you know, they were doing, the one guy I talked to last week, he was doing 12 a month, which means now he's with the COVID-19, everyone's off 50, 60, 70%. So, you know, he's probably doing only 4 or 5 deals a month. So it's a challenge. The little guys are going to have a hard time surviving this whole process.
Right, right. So when did you start your business, Exeter1031.com? When did you start that business?
We started that in 2004 and kind of first rolled out 1031 exchanges and then later rolled out Exeter Trust Company, and now we're in the process of rolling out other products and services under the trust company.
Okay. Okay. Other trust company. Okay. So how many offices do you have, or how big is your business now?
We've got our primary headquarters is here in San Diego, and then we have a number of offices throughout the country. Most of those are sales and business development offices. Our team is 20 people strong that do nothing but 1031 exchanges, either a direct administration with the client or back office operation or sales and marketing.
Okay. So you have offices around, where are your main offices?
The headquarters, of course, is San Diego, and we have a regional office in Cheyenne, Wyoming. That's where the trust company is headquartered, and that's where we're licensed and regulated and audited by the Wyoming Division of Banking. Then we have a regional office in Chicago as well. Okay. And so those are really the three primary offices that we call regional offices.
Okay. But then you have people that work for Exeter that are in all over the United States that look for 1031s and trust business and so forth.
Right.
Absolutely. Okay. That's great. So you've grown a lot since 2004. What has been some of your challenges of growth?
Probably 2008 was our biggest challenge.
Yeah.
We started in 2004, really launched it in a big way in 2005. And so we kind of went right up and then headed right into the recession. And so that's the biggest challenge, because when the recession hit, the capital and credit markets completely froze. The real estate valuations got hit. Nobody had gains. If they did have a gain and wanted to sell and do an exchange, they couldn't get financing. They couldn't get the deal done. So the industry got hit hard. Most of us were down 80, 90, 95% in volume. And wow. So it was really, you couldn't really control the revenue side. You just had to kind of hunker down and control the expense side and wait it out. And first, it was a lot worse and a lot longer than people had anticipated. So a lot of good exchange companies, the smaller mom and pop shops just didn't make it, which is unfortunate, but we survived. So we changed our sales mantra to "We survived, enough said." But it was a long 4 years. I don't want to go through that ever again. But here we are in COVID-19, so kind of a different challenge, different day, but same kind of issues.
I was going to say, because it looks like you're at home, this morning in San Diego. So I guess you're working from home. And how is it going to affect your business in the next 3 months?
Didn't affect the from an operational side, it didn't affect the business at all. We back in 2005, we rolled out a business continuity and disaster recovery plan. So in mid-March, we just rolled that out, sent everybody home. And within 24 hours, we had the entire team of 20 people working from their home office, and we didn't have any glitches at all. So it was a great test to make sure the plan we had already come up with worked, and it worked fine. But the transaction volume, of course, is down, and we'll probably continue to taper off over the next couple of months, and then we'll hit a plateau, and then we'll slowly dig ourselves out of the hole like the industry always does.
Yeah. And so now President Trump's come in and said, okay, well, July 15th is the day. So people are have maybe sold their property, but they have until July 15th. They don't have that 45-day window. They've got until July 15th right now. So are you seeing a big surge of business right before July 15th?
I think we will. We haven't seen that yet, but that's going to happen, I think. What we did see is a lot of people whose, let's say, their 45th day landed maybe the first part of April. And, of course, by that time, most states have locked down. People were working out of their home, what have you. So they couldn't go out and look for real estate and kick the tires and whatnot. And a lot of the real estate firms hadn't figured out exactly how to sell, move properties by that point. So it was kind of uncharted territory. And our advice to clients was the exchange technically failed if they passed their 45-day period with no identification. But we said, don't pull your funds out. We expected some type of an extension. And if you pull your funds out, it becomes taxable. There's nothing that you can do. You can't put the money back and say, I was just kidding. And so we saw a lot of people, of course, just holding the position with us to make sure they would qualify with extensions. Then the extensions came out. So I think now people are beginning to figure out, let's come up with a plan and let's work on it. So a lot of exchanges are just kind of treading water and they're trying to figure out what they want to do at that point. So I think, like you said, just before July 15th, we're going to see a huge flurry of activity.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of concerned about new deals and financing. I mean, cause all the banks are like, they're kind of coming in and they're not necessarily wanting to finance new deals. So can you see that starting to open up in May and June, July?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the difference now is lenders are still kind of still cooperating and working with investors, but they certainly scaled back quite a bit and underwriting guidelines changed and things like that. And we actually saw some lenders who funded and the funds were in the closing and they pulled the funds out the day of closing, which was really unusual. But now we're beginning to see it kind of loosen up a little bit. So I think it'll continue where the lenders will get more back into the game when they realize we're going to survive this and it's not a major disaster. So I think that'll all come back together. We're kind of hoping that as we get to the June 1st and beyond, that we may see another extension of some type, because this is lasting longer than what people had thought. So hopefully the July 15th will be extended, but there's no guarantees. There's been really no talk per se about that. We're just kind of hoping there'll be additional guidance coming out.
Okay. Hey, so last question about business, and we're going to get on to some personal stuff. I know there's some great stuff you want to talk about there. What? How many? I think you mentioned to me how many 1031s you did last year on the webinar.
We do about 2,000 exchanges last year.
2,000. Wow, that's a lot of exchanges, and they all do pretty much brick and mortar. I mean, sell one real estate, go right back in the same real estate. Was that a lot of different? Was there a lot of? Is that 2,000 different people, or was there one company that did 1,000 of them, how many different clients do you think that did that?
There's certainly recurring clients and repetitive transactions and what have you, but that's probably close to maybe 1,900 separate exchanges, separate taxpayers.
Hey, great. Well, that's 2,000. That's a lot of transactions. That's a lot of things. And I know that this year you'll see it not be as good because there's a flurry at the end of the year. And hopefully you can't recommend energy or anybody's product, which we're not want to make sure that we say that on the show. And I probably should have said that in the very beginning, is you're not coming on the show, say anything about our program because you're not. That's not, you can't do that, which is fine with us. We just like the relationships that we bring. So tell me something about your family now, because I think you had a baby not too long ago.
I did. I used to joke that I was on the 50-year plan because I was single for so long, and I was actually very accurate. I just didn't know that. So I got married when I was 50. Wow. And 58 now, my daughter is approaching 17 months coming up. So, yep, we've got a young daughter, and she's just fantastic. In fact, she just attacked me in the background there, if you saw her. So I tried to motion my wife to help me back up.
I saw something in the background. I was like, okay, I need to keep talking because Bill right now is being pulled in a different direction. So, good. Okay, well, that's great. That's great. Good for you. Good for you. And, I can't understand living in Southern California, San Diego, one of the most beautiful places in the world, and saying, okay, so what do you do for fun? Because my wife wants to go to the beach all the time. We don't have very many beaches here in Texas. So my wife would love to come to San Diego, come to the beach. You live on the beach. So what do you and your family like to do?
Certainly beaches is one of the things we love to do, beaches and parks. And in fact, we've just introduced Jasmine, my daughter, to the beach, and she was trying to figure out what the heck sand was. The expressions were priceless. But so far, it seems like she really loves it, so that's awesome. My hobby is scuba diving, so it's kind of all water-related, and we've just scuba dived all over the place. So we do some here in San Diego, although San Diego, because people assume it's warm water, but it's not. It's, Pacific Ocean is the cold water. And so most of the time when we dive locally, it's about 50 degrees when you get down to about 100 feet or so. And, you pass a certain thermocline there, it could drop even lower than that. And you can feel it as you're going through. It just seeps in through that zipper. And
oh, my gosh. Yeah, I bet it's cold. But, of course, you have the Navy SEALs there.
We do.
Yep, well, absolutely. You hear about how cold it is and all the different, what a great place there. So where are some of the places you've been, your favorite places to scuba dive?
Actually, my favorite place is almost in your backyard, Cozumel. It's just easy to get to, and I love the people and, love the food. You can tell by the attire that I wear around in that section. But they got some great diving off of Cozumel Island there, which is a little Mexican island just right off of Cancun. And so if you're actually on Cozumel, you can see Cancun from the island. So that's my favorite spot to go diving. Yeah. We have a small group of us that we've nicknamed the Bad Monkey Divers, and that's a whole other story for a whole other day. But we've traveled all over the world together scuba diving. So probably some of my favorite spots would be Belize. Belize was just an amazing spot. The underwater life is different than here in the U.S. Just the coral and the fish are all different.
Big tuna.
And then, what's that?
Big tuna in Belize?
They have big tuna, a lot of fishing down there. nice strong currents as well. We did a shark dive down there too. That was a lot of fun. That was interesting. And a lot of people are just, oh my God, you scuba dive. Aren't you afraid of sharks? Well, we're not on their menu. So sharks, for the most part, leave you alone. And usually the shark bite you hear about is somebody who probably was not being smart and pushed their luck, or the shark mistook you for other distressed fish and just thought they'd take a nibble. Unfortunately, it's more than a nibble. But my other kind of favorite spot was Palau, so down in Micronesia, south of Indonesia, and everything was different there. You saw a lot of World War II, you know, whether it be planes, ships, the Palau Islands. There's about 700 islands there. Most of the islands are really tiny, but you can find ones where there are outposts and they have the old cannons and what have you. So it was a lot of fun. And underwater with the ships and the Japanese Zeros that had been sunk there, and a lot of neat stuff, a lot of beautiful stuff to see.
Wow, that's great. That's great. I know my wife, Michelle, and I love to scuba dive. And Cozumel is great because when you're scuba diving, you want to be completely still because you don't want to, you know, stir things up or just kind of won't be still. And Cozumel, you can just be still and the current just kind of keep you, kind of rolls you, which is really good in the reefs and everything down here. Just really great. The fish and everything's great. So that's good. And we have been to Belize before and saw big, huge tuna. And we've been to Turks and Caicos, which is one of my favorite spots was Turks and Caicos, but it was before they dredged out and before tourism. Man, I mean, it was, you'd go down 20, 30 feet and then you would see some incredible wildlife. I mean, it was really, really neat. And then they came in and dredged apart for the big cruise ships to come through. And then it kind of went out. But I'm going to tell you my favorite. And I don't know if you've ever done this before, but night dives are by far the best ever. I mean,
absolutely. Completely agree.
I mean, 40, 50 feet, night dives with a flashlight. And I mean, everything comes out at night and it's just so much better. And we were on this trip. I can't remember what it was, but we went like every day. We got up early in the morning, drug everything out to the boat. We went scuba diving and then we came back and missed the day. I couldn't play golf. We were scuba diving all. And then like on, we were there over the weekend and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then Thursday night, we went on a night dive for like 2 hours with a group of people that we had met at the hotel. And frankly, I loved it more than I loved any of the day dives. And I said, honey, we've missed this whole thing about diving. We need to just do night dives. Do two of those would be equivalent to anything else because it is just so neat because everything's out there.
Absolutely true. Yeah, agree with that. Just the tough part is that a lot of people don't want to do night dives. So trying to get a dive boat who can get enough people to go out is always the challenge. But I'll go out on a night dive anytime.
Yeah, it is. It is so much better. It is so much better. I really like it a lot. I know that because people think that it's, you know, it's not, I mean, if you go 20, 30 feet, you can still see a lot of a nightlife and you can still see if the moon's out, which it normally is, you can see the top. So it's not like you're claustrophobic. And that's what people are afraid of is that you're going to get down there and it's going to be all dark and you're going to be freaking out, but it's really not that bad. I mean, we have gone into some caves before and that is kind of claustrophobic and all that, but just in a normal night dive, you know, going out, it is the most beautiful. The colors of everything is just so beautiful. I got to call my wife and tell her we got to go on another scuba diving trip. I've got a picture of me and her on my desk. It's my screensaver of us scuba diving, and we just love it. So maybe one of these days I could join your BMD. Was that bad?
The Bad Monkey Divers. Yep.
Bad Monkey Divers. Do you have any logos or T-shirts or anything?
No, we don't. We should. It just kind of it was a long story, but you know, we ended up realizing the five of us traveled well together, and we've been stranded in places, and you know, things go wrong in trips, and you find out who can handle that when life throws you a curveball, and who can't handle it. So the five of us have just been able to go through a lot of stuff together and just have fun. So that's what counts.
Only men. So it's only men.
Nope. In the group. Nope. It's mixed. Yeah, it's mixed group. So three women, two guys.
Okay. All right.
So, one of them was the she when she started diving with us, she had only had four dives under her belt. Now she's an instructor for instructors, so she's gone all the way with her certifications.
Wow!
And she was also the one of the dive masters at Mandalay Bay. So you could actually go in and dive the Mandalay Bay shark encounter. They allow about 12 divers a week that can go in there and actually dive the aquarium. And you can't use your equipment. You have to use their equipment. They are very good about taking care of the sharks and the other wildlife that's in the aquarium. But that was an amazing experience. It's actually, the weird part was not the sharks. The weird part was the fact that you have 100 tourists looking in the window at you.
Oh, wow. That's fun. I've never heard that. That'd be something really neat to do.
Yeah. If you ever want to do it, I'd meet you out there and I'd do it again in a heartbeat. It was fantastic. Awesome.
That's great. That's great. Good for you. Okay. So I want to wrap up, but I also want to talk about real quick about, you know, what would you tell yourself if you were 20 years old, or what do you tell somebody about, you know, if you were talking to college students or high school students, or what would be your pep talk about life? What is it that you found that has been really, really important to you?
You know, I think, We've done a lot of presentations to colleges and things like that too, you know, career nights and things like that. And I think the thing I always come up with is persistence. Just never give up. You know, business life throws you lots of curveballs, economies, recessions, what have you. If you're starting your own business, it's good. There's ups and downs and challenges. And the first couple of years are always rough when you start one up. Just don't give up. Be persistent. Keep pushing forward. If you got a vision, stick with it. Otherwise, it just, you know, you keep failing. So persistence, I think, is what it really boils down to. It's you just got to believe in yourself and push forward.
Yeah. What drives you? What is your, do you look at it as a 5-year goal or 10-year goal or something? And what drives you every day?
No, I just love what we do. It's the fact that I spoke to a college class about a month ago, and they asked that question too. And I said, you know, every now and then you get an answer that comes out and you go, well, that makes sense. So I said, you know, it's kind of like a big game of Monopoly, but it's real stakes. And I said, it's just fun doing business. It's fun helping clients with their exchanges and their retirement accounts and things like that. It's a positive message because you're helping them get deals done. You're helping them defer taxes. You're helping them build wealth. That's a very technical area. So it's, you know, important to have your expertise and experience that you can relay to clients and help them get through that. It's one of those things where just once it gets in your blood, it's you're stuck with it.
Yeah. Well, and two, you've got Jasmine now that you know, 17 months old. You got to stick around and you got to screw with her.
And now she's like, Daddy, college, come on.
It is expensive. Take it from me. I've got four in different private schools everywhere. So. It does get expensive. So any more children on the horizon?
Nope, that's first and last.
First and last, okay, good, that's great. And I'll tell you what, I've really, really enjoyed this, and I tell you, you know, you've done such a great job at building an incredible business. I mean, it is hard to not only be an entrepreneur, you know, like you are, but to build up, I mean, you know, you don't really make a ton of money off these 1031s, And to do that many and to build that business up, I know it took time and a lot of persistence, you know, so I know that's a pretty good. And I tell you, I really enjoy getting to know you and honor that about you.
Likewise. Absolutely. That's awesome. It's certainly 1031 exchange business is certainly a volume business.
Yeah, I know. And I mean, you've just done a great job in building branches all over, and now you're starting a trust company. So not only 1031s, but you do trust for clients. I'm assuming you're kind of putting a vertical there.
Yeah, the trust company was a natural progression because it allowed us to offer qualified trust accounts to every single 1031 exchange client. That way the funds are very clearly held as trust funds, not corporate funds. There's a bankruptcy case for Land America 1031 Exchange, for those who are aware of them. And the judge ruled they were corporate funds, not client funds. And that was the industry was kind of shocked. We weren't. We knew the way the contracts are drafted, that's the way the judge would rule. So part of this was to clearly delineate that these are trust funds, client funds. The other part is we wanted to make sure that we were licensed and regulated and audited by a third party. So we thought, well, let's go with the trust company route. That way we have a license and regulation we have to stick with. We have significant equity capital requirements, and we get an annual audit so they can come in and make sure that we're operating in a safe and sound manner. And then it also gives us the ability to diversify into other revenue and products. So we're rolling out self-directed IRAs where clients can use their IRAs to actually buy and invest in real estate. So the real estate can be purchased inside the IRA, whether it be real estate, mortgages, deeds of trust, tax lien certificates, oil and gas, you know, et cetera. We'll roll out general custody services for people who want to have a third party hold an account for their assets and income and revenues and expenses and things like that. And then we do specialized holding escrow. So we don't want to compete with our escrow and title company partners. But when there's a escrow type need that they can't do for regulatory reasons, we can take a look at that as a trust company and hold assets, whether it be cash, documents, or whatnot, for specific reasons under an escrow agreement. And we'll be doing some land trust work as well. So it gives us the ability to kind of do other stuff to help clients solve specific problems they might have.
Well, and I know that you're one of the only ones that is, I think you mentioned on the webinar, like 1% of the people are regulated as you are.
Yeah, less than 1% of qualified intermediaries have any kind of government oversight. And that was one of our objectives, is to make sure we fall into that 1% where we have that government oversight.
Well, that is amazing. I mean, I guess could I be a qualified intermediary? Could I just put a sign on my door and just go, I'm a qualified intermediary, and get some accounts?
Anybody can set up shop. There's one up in LA that worked for another exchange company for 5 months and then quit and started their own company. It's like in 5 months, there's no way you can have enough expertise to advise clients. But it's as easy as setting up a shop like that. So having that government oversight is critical to show that somebody's watching to make sure that everything is operating in a safe and sound manner.
Yeah, well, Bill, I'm not gonna do that, because I wouldn't want to compete against you. I mean, my goodness, you know, that's awesome. Well, I'll tell you what, Bill, I've really enjoyed this time with you, and
I have too. Thank you.
Really got great to know you, and I look forward to maybe scuba diving in Mandalay Bay in Las Vegas or somewhere else. I mean, I'd love to do some night dives, and I'm really missing that. My wife was calling me a minute ago, and that's why I phoned her. But I'm gonna tell her that we got to get on. We got our next trip has to be a scuba diving trip.
Perfect. You know, I'll meet you there.
And I look forward to getting to know you better in the future and working with you and getting to know your wife and seeing little Jasmine grow up. That sounds great.
Perfect. Thanks for having us on. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bill. Have a great day, and look forward to the future with you.
Sounds good. Thanks so much. Take care. Bye-bye.